There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome to the Prospects Podcast. I'm Tom Clark, and this week we're going to be talking to the Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller on what he calls narrative economics. That is the way that stories help shape our economy. First, though, I'm joined by my colleague, Samir Rahim. Samir, I think it's true to say, isn't it, with so much politics and constitutional crisis going on in Westminster here, we kind of forget about the economy a bit, don't we?
Yes, it seems so. And I wonder what the state of the world economy is right now. How do you see it?
I'm not giving it the attention that perhaps I should because of all that politics. But it's true to say that growth has slowed worldwide. And, you know, for example, the Federal Reserve is now cutting interest rates rather than talking about raising them anymore. And whereas not long ago, like the early signs of this slowdown were being put down to special factors, US trade war, something going on with car emission standards. You know, there's always special reasons why things might be slowing. But I think it looks a little bit more general maybe now. And there's other uncertainties in there. We saw a spike after those attacks on the Saudi oil refineries in the oil price only this week. So it's not a catastrophe. We're not on the edge of a 2008 crash, but it does look like it's a period of slower growth.
And what about in Britain? Are we heading towards the sunlit uplands that were promised?
No, we're not. Britain's growth has slowed, and we know that a lot of investment has been held right back. Living standards actually are going up a bit, which they haven't been for a while. But the economy does look a bit dicey. And of course, this brings us back to the politics. We know what that is. Companies are saying we're going to see where Brexit comes out before we decide if to make that investment or not.
And is it going to be the case that there might be a sort of false dawn? You know, if there is a Brexit deal, companies have certainty and then they'll start investing again. And there might be a sort of little boost to the economy, even though in the long term, as we've explained in the magazine many times, Brexit will probably do quite a lot of damage.
I think there would be a pickup, because if lots of people are holding back on investment, and certainly this might be, you know, if a foreign firm is looking at expanding a car plant or something, they'd certainly want to know what's going on with Brexit before they invested something. But any company anywhere that just wants to know if it's all looking a bit dicky, if there's suddenly, after all this talk of no deal, a deal after all, there'll be a collective sigh of relief and those investments will go ahead. People will have certainty, and the Brexit related slowdown we've seen in the first or second quarter of this year, I think, would then be reversed. In 10 years time, it wouldn't be a pickup maybe that people would remember. It'd be a passing thing, but it might be enough to avert a sinking in this sluggish world economy.
So like any narrative, it all depends on when you start the story and when you end the story. So looking at it across a sort of 5-year period is often very different looking at a sort of 50-year period. So some of the Brexiteers might say, well, we'll have a 10-year, you know, slowdown or whatever, but then after then, we'll go up. The Nike tick, Boris Johnson talks about.
And we know that Jacob Rees-Mogg famously did talk about, you know, the 50-year picture, which might sound rather a long time to a lot of people. I mean, I think, you know, if there's a Brexit deal, like possibly growth will be lower than it would have been probably, you know, in over a 5 or 10 year period. And it's a bit of a fool's game to guess too far beyond that. But if we go out with no deal in a month or two, I think the effects will be quite pronounced for quite a long time. First of all, because some sectors, including cars, in the first instance face tariffs. Secondly, there's sort of particular pockets of trade, like with Ireland, that we know are going to be complicated. Thirdly, there'll just be a general sense that people still don't know where they stand, because no deal is just the start of lots and lots of dealing. So this whole uncertainty thing then rolls on and on and on for as far as the eye can see. And I think that, yeah, if you look back at that in certainly in 10 years time, you'll still see it as a real hit.
So what can we do about it? Are there any particular solutions apart from just stopping Brexit? Or,
well, I think there are things, because the government has got its overdraft down. You'll remember after the last crisis, the government spent a lot of money, it printed a lot of money, but quite soon we were into austerity, which a lot of people, including me, had a lot of worries about. But the one thing about having a smaller overdraft now is you've at least got the capacity to make your overdraft bigger again if we have a recession. So I think there are some things we'll be able to do. But before we get on to having the right cure or finding the right cure, we'll probably need to make sure we've got the right diagnosis, the right understanding. Are we really any further along to answering the Queen's famous question on visiting the LSE in 2008? Why did nobody see it coming? Well, there's one man with a better track record than most in seeing busts coming, and that's the Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller, who is now suggesting in a new book that economists might do well to obsess a little less with their charts and equations and rediscover the art of storytelling instead.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Robert Shiller, thank you so much for coming into the Prospect podcast. Very welcome to you. Tell us a little bit about your idea about narrative and economics. What has narrative got to do with economics?
Well, most economists don't think it has anything to do with economics. The standard paradigm today is most commonly is that economic decisions are rational, calculated, consistent. People have a utility function, doesn't change through time, and they know what they want. The narrative economics that I am defining takes a different view of human nature. People are sometimes like that, but you know, they don't get around. How many times have you thought about how much you should save for retirement? And do you have a view in your mind that what percent I should save at various ages? Probably not. Can you remember a dinner conversation about such an abstract topic? They don't talk about it. In fact, the dinner conversation that you hear will be stories about somebody who made a lot of money or lost a lot of money or was in poverty now. Those are contagious. And ultimately, people make their saving decisions based on these stories. So we have to study the stories if we want really to have a full understanding of economic fluctuations.
Does that mean that you think an awful lot of economics that's been done is wrong or just misleading?
Well, I like economics, and I like the models that are fully rational as beginnings of thought. But I just think that there's something fundamental about the stories that people were telling, and particularly with regard to big events like Brexit or immigration policy in many countries or about economic fluctuations. What caused the Great Depression? In fact, you know, that's a story that will stop a lot of people in their tracks. I don't know. People will say, I don't know what caused it. The stock market crash caused it of 1929. But that what caused the stock market crash of 1929? Then they'll say, well, maybe the Federal Reserve, the central bank, did it. Because there isn't a role in most people's thinking for some change in psychology that ultimately did it. It's a little bit hard to be precise. And economists like to be precise. And they don't like to be quoting hearsay. That seems unprofessional. And up until now, we haven't really had good ways of measuring narratives, except that we would quote, I heard the other day such and such. And it just offends their sense of professionalism. They assume that the narratives are just the outcome of economic processes, and they don't feed back in to change the processes.
You get these stories sometimes, don't you, where someone's done a paper that looks at what is the best predictor of a recession, and it might be how often the word recession features in a newspaper.
Right.
In other words, that something in the mood has changed, or maybe a story that people have got about where the country's going.
Mood changes are typically a surprise to economists. We're talking about mood of a whole nation or of the whole world. The whole world goes into mood changes. And they don't seem to recognize there's any way to get insights into these changes. So they don't talk about. They have confidence indexes, which was one important development more than a half century ago. But why confidence is going up and down is too mushy a topic for them. But I think if you look at big events, it kind of jumps out at you that the origin of these events is involved with some stories that. For example, stories of immigrants defiling our culture or committing crimes, or those stories are lively, and they're not necessarily any truth to them.
You were talking earlier about what happened in the Great Depression, and it was very striking for me when we had a sort of, you know, the great crash of 2007-08, when there was a run on the banks in this country, and we had lines around the block of people wanting to take their money out of Northern Rock. And in a way, as an individual, your narrative says, my money's there, it's under risk, I want to take it out. But collectively, that's the worst possible thing that you could be doing. So is there a sort of conflict between like an individual's story in the way they look at the world, and then obviously, you know, the grand narrative that, that governments need to think about?
Well, I think it is important that governments do think about these narratives. And I think that your government came through with Northern Rock. They immediately took action to raise the limit on how much would be insured. Ex post, they just increased the insurance. And so that stopped it. They knew that there was still a collective memory of bank runs, although the last bank run in Britain, I think, was in 1866. It could come back, because these stories are, it would come back like a new epidemic of fear. And the way that takes hold is through talk, right? That's how you, it's both talk in the news media, but more importantly, it's talk among friends, and because people tend to respond to one-on-one communications. We don't observe the one-on-one communication, which makes it difficult. But I think we're getting closer to it with digitized text and ability to search with natural language processing so that we can actually get something that's more hard evidence about what people are talking about.
Does this mean something a bit odd in terms of economic policy? Does it mean that what you actually want in a leader might be someone who can spin a good yarn? You know, so that, like, to give a more positive example, it might be Franklin Roosevelt saying the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and now I'm here, so you don't need to be fearful anymore. To give possibly a more controversial example, it could be Donald Trump, like, boasting about the Wall Street going through the roof, or Boris Johnson saying, as he has done this week, what this country needs is to put some tiger in its tank, whatever that means.
Well, you give great examples. I've had the same examples on my mind. So Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated in early 1933 amidst a banking crisis. He had to shut the banking system down. But the economy started to recover dramatically at that point. So I think that his pep talk did help, but it wasn't able to counter the power of other narratives that were, and the Depression ran on until World War II. But I think of these events as fundamentally tied to those narratives. After World War II, people thought, well, we're going to go right back into a depression. We don't have Franklin Roosevelt anymore at that point. But it didn't. And I don't know that there's any consensus. Why did the economy of the United States boom after World War II? And in the book, I give some examples of things that were happening. One thing that I found, this is only part of a constellation of narratives, but there was a narrative during World War II about the victory vacation. Now, this might seem irrelevant, I mean, but let me just tell it. People started talking about, you know, this war is such a nightmare. We're okay, though. We're going to take a big vacation and celebrate. And then so right after the war, the newspapers were filled with ads from vacation spots. Take your victory vacation here. And it was like a party atmosphere after the war. I don't know what it was like in Britain.
I'm a bit more ration books, I think.
Well, you had been suffered damage, and there was no damage in the United States. So somehow that set a new narrative. The economists were worried about a return of the Great Depression, but people weren't, so it didn't return.
How interesting. And would it mean, I'm trying to get even more controversial now, that if you're in a country like China, where, of course, the government can control not only the newspapers, but also to some extent social media, I mean, you can imagine this becoming a kind of argument for a very sort of authoritarian, top-down form of economic governance where the good news is going to keep coming.
Yeah, that's the worry, especially with modern communications technology, if it comes under the thumb of some authoritarian government.
But it could be kind of benign in the sense it could give everyone reason to keep up confidence, and then the confidence self-justifies.
Yeah, well, I think there is a role for government officials to try to manage confidence somewhat, but it's a little bit tricky doing that. So I was mentioning Northern Rock as an example where they did well. And I think it's not because of what they learned in graduate school. It's because of their natural instincts to imagine what the response might be if they let Northern Rock fail and default on deposits.
When you look at a country like Britain at the moment, where there's a big argument going on about, in a sense, what the country's story and what the country's account of itself is, you know, there's going to be effects from leaving the European Union on certain tariff lines, but lots of those tariff lines are actually quite low.
Yeah.
And you might adjust to them. But if we have a very different sense of ourselves, a different sort of country that has less connection with, say, continental Europe than with the United States or other parts of the world, do you think that could turn out to be the real meaning of Brexit?
Well, that's what caused Brexit, right? Isn't it? It's the same story. I don't understand why the U.S. story isn't more favorable to Britain. It seems like we're British, too. We speak English. There was some sense of differentiation and identity that took hold in the U.S., and they don't think that we are thankful. We should be thankful for our British culture.
Mm.
The narrative split in 1776 or thereabouts, and it stays. Narratives can stay for a long, long time.
So, sorry, do you mean that mainstream British nationalism is skeptical of America, or do you see it as fawning towards America these days?
I don't know that I would say fawning.
But does it want to embrace America, or does it want to push America away?
I don't know. What my instinct would be to talk about the common culture of our two countries.
Mm.
That sounds positive. And I think we do have, and we can bring in Hong Kong and other places that also share in this common culture.
It's interesting, isn't it? You were talking about immigration earlier, and during the Brexit referendum, I think it was attributed to the then Chancellor George Osborne. He said, "Well, no one's going to vote for Brexit because, you know, no one's going to vote to be poorer just because a Polish person has moved next door to them." And maybe, despite economists, many, if not most economists in this country saying that Brexit will make people poorer, they did in fact vote for it. But maybe again, we're talking about the individual. So maybe as an individual, you feel like someone from another country is coming to take your job. That perception is there, whether that's true or not. And they don't see it on the grander scale that actually overall being closer to Europe instead of trading partnerships is better for everyone. So maybe it's a difference between your individual narrative and your collective narrative.
Well, narratives have two different sources. One is the media, who are in business over spinning narratives. And the other is your friends. In both cases, contagion differs from one narrative to another. But mm-hmm. in the news media, people who have to get attention, they tend to hype certain things. And that's part of what's happening right now, is that news media, there's a poll. Isn't it true in Britain there's more polarization of newspapers?
Yes.
So there's other things that are happening now that create polarization of narratives, namely the ability of people to find like-minded people on the internet. And you don't have to, you can spend a lot of screen time. This changes the pattern of narrative, but I think the narrative as a driver of economies goes back thousands of years, actually. It's not new, but it's maybe...
What's your oldest example?
My oldest example, well, it's an example. You want an example of a narrative?
Of a narrative affecting the economy somewhere.
Well, I use that the word rumor in Latin mm. means, translated into English, rumor. It's another word for fake news, right?
Yeah.
So they were very much aware that rumors cause things. As an example of a narrative that is still being told, that's still economically important, I refer you to the Iliad by Homer, which talks about the tripods of Hephaestus. Do you remember that? Maybe you don't remember
that. I'm afraid not, but I should.
It's bizarre that this was in the Iliad, but he talks about a craftsman who built a tripod that would travel on its own and could be programmed to go to the abode of the gods and then come back. Okay. It was a robot. talked about there. So the idea, there were other mentions of robots, and they didn't use the word robot, but of machines that replace people in the ancient world. I don't want to make too much of it,
yeah.
But there was some of that. The idea that machines are replacing jobs and I have to worry is one of my perennial narratives that I talk about in the book.
Because, I mean, that is an interesting one, isn't it? Because for 250 years, at least, machines have been replacing certain types of work.
Right.
But in the last 7-8 years, that's become a real talking point. And it might be something that comes up when you're talking to non-economists at dinner.
That's right. It's come up at various times in history. It came up with the Luddites in 1811, and it came up again in other events in the 19th century. It came up in the Great Depression as technological unemployment, they called it. They had a new name for it. They used to call it labor-saving machines. It came up in the 1950s when the new word was automation. And then it came up more recently, and the new word is artificial intelligence.
And so do you have a thought as to why it becomes a talking point in, say, the full employment 1950s? Okay.
It has something to do with our identity. We tend to identify with our jobs, and these machines are replacing jobs. So you used to, back in the 19th century, you felt some identity with the rural area where you lived and worked on a farm. But if that job is disappearing, and it has been, or that was a big trend in the 19th century, that you had to move to the city, it was very challenging.
Mm. So the disruption that you can either see or feel makes you
And worry about the future. So the artificial intelligence narrative is right now profoundly worrying, and it doesn't just affect manual labor anymore. It affects college-educated people and things that you used to pride yourself on. I used to pride myself on how I could, in the night, I could identify the stars and the constellations and tell you how far away that star is. I was an astronomy nut. But I was totally replaced. Now you can get on your cell phone. You just hold it up to the sky and it shows labels of what's what up there. Even in the daytime, I can hold it up and see what's up there. So that was challenging to my ego, although I've long ago given up that pretense.
So human beings, sort of when they start to feel redundant or the roles that they have assigned for themselves become, start to disappear. What other narratives around there, maybe more extreme ideologies, they can come to take their place? Would you say that's true?
That's right. So one reason why immigration as a narrative has taken hold is that it sounds like something we can stop. And it sounds like the march forward of artificial intelligence is inevitable and can't be stopped. So it for politicians, it often pays to talk about the immigration problem rather than the computer problem.
Can I ask you a final question on the nature of what people like you do, science and social science? Scientists are very proud that what they do is disinterested, it's empirical, it's led by the evidence and not by preconceptions. But when you're looking at the rest of society and business, thinking people are being scattered around by stories, do you worry about it in your profession too?
Well, this book is an outgrowth of my American Economic Association presidential address. And when I prepared my address, I read other ones, and I find that this tends to be an opportunity to criticize your own profession in front of it, in their faces. So I decided I would do that. And there is a tendency for academicians in any department to follow fads or trends in their own department. And they want, as you say, they want to be precise and scientific, but sometimes they don't succeed, and it's missing the phenomenon when the phenomenon is more human. So Alfred Marshall said over 100 years ago, economics is not an exact science, but the way it's presented is often as if it were. For example, with the recent talk about the inverted yield curve, where the short rates are above long rates, is taken as a scientific observation, not as something that it was maybe ephemeral. It might have been tied in with a narrative. It's become a narrative.
The idea that this predicts recession.
That it predicts, like there is some deep reason why it predicts a recession. And maybe there is, but I suspect it's more transient. They weren't talking about the inverted yield curve 50 or 100 years ago. They had very different ways of viewing the economy. They didn't even talk much about the stock market. When you go back to earlier panics, or crises, it tended to be about banks. They say the Dow Jones Industrial Average was created in the 1890s, which is true, but nobody paid any attention to it, almost nobody except a few professionals, until around 1929. and then the stock market became a barometer, people thought, of the state of the economy. Why would they think that? But they did. And now you'll see it on the news. If you watch the evening news, every day they say what the market did. You know, so the market went up 3 points yesterday. What use is that to most people? Why do they have to see that every day? It's because they view that as part of, they still remember the 1929 narrative. That story has become part of our lore. I think the 1987 crash is fading. Young people have never heard of it. They know 1929 better than 1987.
Stories move with the times, I guess. Robert, thank you very much indeed.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And that's all for this week. Robert Shiller's new book is Narrative Economics: How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events. Thank you all very much for listening. Rebecca Liu was this week's producer. And if you enjoyed the Prospect podcast, then please do leave us a rating and review, which really does help. We'll see you again next time. Goodbye.